So I have the honor to introduce Joe McRae. He is the CEO of Strategic Security, and he's going to talk about all of the effort that we tend to put in all the wrong places in terms of security and how that can result in inconsistencies in our expectations of how things turn out. Okay, with that, Joe.
Thanks a lot. Let's see if this is on. Everybody hear me okay? All right, great. Okay, guys, we made it to the end of the day. Who's ready for beer 30? Yeah, we're about done. Who's like, okay, I've seen enough death by PowerPoint. Anybody feeling that one? All right, so you can handle another hour of it, yeah? He's like, yeah, of course I can. Okay. All right, let's see if this actually works. So if Windows doesn't work, can I like call tech support here? I'm serious, this really isn't freaking working. Okay, guys, so who am I? I'm an application network security guy, hacker, call it whatever you want, AKA the black guy at security conferences. Generally, what I run into is people like, you're the Afro-colored, you ever see how people get so worried about insulting you that they like overdo it and like, it takes them like 20 minutes to say hello? Anybody ever run into that? Okay. All right, so let's get talking. All right, I hope I don't offend anybody. I am not politically correct. Let's just get this straight right now. Okay, I do things like hack. I do things like curse. I do consume alcohol on a very regular basis. The order of the three changes periodically, but it's the same three things I do. Okay, you don't need to ask me, hey Joe, what'd you do this weekend? It's gonna be one of these three. Cool? All right, let's do this. All right, guys, let me take you back. Anybody been popping boxes for a while? Anybody been owning stuff for a good minute? All right, if you've been owning stuff for a good minute, just kind of come back with me, all right? Let's go back to yesteryear. I've been pen testing pretty much since Jesus was walking the earth, man. I've been popping boxes for a good minute. And back in the good old days, pen testing was cool because I would show up at the client site and people would be like, oh, my God, the security guy's here. And all I had to tell a customer to do back then was apply a patch. And that was it. I'd be like, man, if you would just apply these patches, everything will be okay. Everything will be okay. Customers used to say stuff to me like, it might break something. That was it. Anybody remember that? Does anybody remember when Nessus was free? Come on, where's my people? Right? When we rolled up and we had Nessus and people were like, oh, he's got those hacker tools. He's using Nmap. Right? Those were the good days, man. You did it something like this, right? If you were hardcore, man, you port scanned the planet. You broke out Nmap, scanned everything. There were no firewalls back then, right? We just scanned and scanned and scanned and scanned, and we found everything unpatched. Everything? Okay, let's try this one more time. Everything? You say everything.
Everything?
Everything? Everything was unpatched back then. It was awesome. We would drop shells on everything. You'd go to PacketStorm, you'd go to exploit.be, rootshell.be, all that stuff. USSR back. Anybody remember those? Right? We would, man, hack.co.za. After that, we took pictures of everything we owned. Remember that? See, this was your data. This was your firewall. This was your database, right? Then we'd write a report that looked something like this. Anybody remember writing this report? Right? We all did this one, right? Anybody? Okay, then the important part comes next, right? 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 Consulting 101. Everyone, stick out your right hand. Pay me. That's consulting. Today, it's a little different, right? Everybody's got everything, right? And everybody's a security expert. They got firewalls, antivirus, intrusion detection, intrusion prevention, network access control. You know, it's everything. There's anti stuff. Anybody kind of feeling like they got so much anti stuff in front of the other anti stuff in front of the other anti stuff that's protecting a Solaris 2.7 box running Telnet? Anybody? Don't act like it's just me with this customer. Okay, so what do I do now? So now, today, it's not about finding if stuff is still vulnerable, because stuff is still vulnerable. Like, they didn't fix anything. All they did was just put more crap in front of what's already jacked up, right? So, in other words, they blew $200 million in security crap instead of fixing what was broke in the first place. Anybody? Okay, I just want to make sure we're all on the same page. So, scenario that I had, about a year, a year and a half ago now, almost 2 years. So I had this customer, very, very large bank, multi-billion dollar bank, hires my company. It's like, okay, Joe, we're going to do internal black box, external black box, web app, wireless, physical, all this cool stuff. However, we really need you to try to not get detected. And if you do get detected, the project is over. Okay? Then they gave us some other cool things, like no social engineering. Anybody love that one? Because then the customer told me, look, Joe, I can't pay you to tell me I need user awareness training. I can't do that. I can't pay you to tell me I need user awareness training. So now I give them all the statistics. Look at all these social engineering statistics. And look at all these compromise statistics. And look at all these user interaction statistics. I got to send PDF exploits. I got to send office documents. I got to do it. And then the customer was like, no, we won't pay you. I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to do whatever the hell you want so I can get the check. Okay, got a girlfriend who likes very expensive purses, very expensive shoes. It's the only reason I'm in this business, right? Because I just don't make enough money at McDonald's, so this is it. Okay, so I log on to the box. Basically, what they did was they gave me an account as a user at the bank, in the mailroom, basically, right? So what happened is they had laid off something like 16,000 employees. Then when they laid off everybody, they realized they laid off too many people. Then it was like, uh-oh. Oh, shit. So then they turned around and they said, well, let's hire all these people back. But the people they hired back were contractors at a lower pay rate. So then it was like, ugh, maybe we should do a security assessment where someone pretends to be one of these local contractors and tries to see if he can escalate privileges to get access to stuff we don't want him to get access to. That became Joe. All right. So I go to the bank. I get an account, and you see that I'm, you know, McCray J is my account name. I look in control panel, and I see that they've got antivirus, they got host intrusion prevention, Altiris is a patch management system, and they got Big Brother network monitoring. And they got this on every endpoint in the environment. So my guess is that they probably have network intrusion prevention too, right? Anybody? Yeah? Big bank, so they probably have a web application firewall too, right? Fairly reasonable to assume. Big banks, so they probably got a load balancer as well, yeah? XML gateway, that kind of stuff. Reasonable to assume. All right, so the customer wanted us to give them like an attack path. So our first week we got domain admin. Obviously, right? Because they had all that security stuff. So our first week, we're domain admin. So now you're going to see, like, down here in the bottom right corner, that's my company logo. So it's like, hey, this is us, domain admin. Now, all those other triangles are all the other domains owned by the company. So each week, what we would do is we would show them that we own more stuff. Then I came across this thing called Swift. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of Swift. It's how they transfer money between banks. It's not anything important. It's just how they, you know, move the money from here. Any of you guys ever run into that? So I don't know about you, but it's kind of like the likelihood of me getting Megan Fox pregnant. It was one of those things that I was like, it's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. But I'm right there, and I see the Swift thing, and of course, the director of information security and the CIO are sitting right there. So it's like, damn, I can't do it. I want to do it, though. Who's thinking, where would you go? Caymans? Who's thinking, Caymans? I'm thinking about it. I'm like, man, I could stop pen testing right now. This could be it. So I want to do it. I want to do it, but damn, let me just own another domain. So I go ahead and I own the next domain. And by this point, we're on our second week. So after that, by the third week, we've owned pretty much everything. I couldn't get the firewalls. I was trying, but I couldn't get the firewall. So we put our logo on everything that we compromised, and I could not get them damn firewalls. I was trying. And then finally, I had to kind of let the customer know a little secret after he paid me, of course. This is very important. after he paid me. So he's like, Joe, I just love how you guys took all the time to visualize our network, and you know, the PowerPoint looks so good. And I never told him that those were the network admin's diagrams that I stole to make the PowerPoint, you know. I mean, it's a value add. Anybody with me? Value add? It's a value add. I'm the consultant. I'm here to give value to the whole thing. Okay, you know how it goes. So how do I do this stuff? So the first thing that I use is Google. I know you guys probably love Bing, but Bing stands for, but it's not Google. We realize that. This is what we do. What, did I say something bad? It's not like I'm at Microsoft or anything, am I? Oops. Okay, so first thing I do, I drop these out here and I start looking for SQL injection. The fastest way to find SQL injection is to use Google and look for database errors. My friend Don Ankney's here, and he's the security guy for Bing, and I've been begging him to allow me to use these Google operators in Bing, and he just won't let me do it. I've been asking him like to make a project plan and let us to do all the Google hacking in Bing, and he's just not feeling it. Can y'all put in a request or something like that? I would switch to Bing if you'd let me do more of this. All right, so we look for all the Google hacking stuff. If you look for database error messages, fastest way to find SQL injection. If you look for references to files, fastest way to find file includes, local file includes, remote file includes, great ways to find log file injection. You know, when you're up against these networks that have web application firewalls and intrusion prevention systems, the last thing you want to do is scan. You don't want to be running scanners because they're going to see you, they're going to block you, they're going to laugh at you. We don't want that. We want to own people, right? So do your best to use this stuff. Next thing is do your passive recon. There's this amazing tool called Firefox. Don't know if you guys have ever heard of it. Firefox has all these cool security add-ons. Firefox Passive Recon is the one that I like. And it allows me to do a lot of the footprinting and figure out, you know, DNS servers and find PDF files and find Office documents and all that kind of stuff. Download those Office documents, search the metadata for the Office documents. You'll often find, excuse me, you'll often find usernames in there. You'll find directory names, to like map drives and stuff like that. You can find so much from metadata in Office documents stored on people's servers. Next thing, OSINT. We do open source intelligence reports where we collect every bit of data that we can find about a target company. And we put that all in and we give that to the customers. I'm finding that's one of those things that's really, really helpful. I strongly recommend that you do that stuff against your own company as much as you can. You'd be surprised just how much information you can find out about key employees, you know, corporate infrastructure, all kinds of stuff like that. I don't have enough time to show it right now, but if you guys catch me either after this speech or at the little night party thing, give me some alcohol, show you all this kind of stuff. All right, next thing, load balancers. I run into load balancers a lot. I think one of the things that you'll find out is a lot of these large organizations like Microsoft like to use load balancers because they're dealing with so much traffic, right? So if you're trying to identify a load balancer, you're going to find that you need to be able to figure out what the IP address of the real web server is. So being able to detect load balancing, find out the true IP is going to be really, really critical. Is it DNS load balancing? Is it HTTP load balancing? Is it both? So we go through a whole series of ways to do that. You can use Firefox Live HTTP headers. You can make multiple requests to the same web server or the same DNS name. And if you look in the HTTP server response, a lot of times you'll see that timestamps change. So you might see it's, let's say it's 2:01 p.m. and you keep making requests, you see 2:01 p.m. in 5 seconds, 2:01 in 7 seconds, 2:01 in 9 seconds, 2:01 in 1 seconds. Again, you now know you're up against the load balancer because even though they have synchronized time, there starts to be some deviation between the different servers. So even though you're querying the same domain name and the same IP, because you're getting back those small changes in the HTTP header response, you go, oh, it's load balanced, right? You can also do that with DIG if it's DNS load balanced. You can also use things like Netcraft. Netcraft is great for trying to figure out if a host is load balanced or not. Since they're periodically spidering the internet, you'll start to find companies where it'll say that they have an F5 Big IP, Citrix NetScaler, like what Microsoft is running, that kind of stuff. All right, next thing, intrusion prevention systems. What you're going to find with intrusion prevention systems is essentially, as soon as you send a bad request, they're either going to give you a reset packet or they're going to block your IP address. So we try to throw the easiest things that we possibly can at the box. Now, everybody, let me make sure I let you know, this attack has not worked since Jesus was walking the earth. Everybody with me? Don't go try this. This is not a real attack anymore. However, if you throw something like ... WinNT System32 CMD.exe, if there's an intrusion prevention system in place, you'll immediately see that you get a reset packet back. It kills your connection or it blocks your IP address. You now know that you're up against an intrusion prevention system. You kind of see what I'm going for, guys? When you're dealing with these types of systems, what you want to know is, what am I up against? The hardest part about bypassing security mechanisms is figuring out that that's there, right? It's one of those things that if you don't kind of press the test button and figure out what's there, you're going to have a tough time compromising anything. So over the years, I've kind of morphed my pen test methodology so that now my whole first day of the pen test is just discovering security mechanisms, trying to see if there's a load balancer, trying to see if there's an intrusion prevention system, trying to see if there's a WAF, trying to see if there's an XML gateway. Those are those things you got to figure out. Once you can figure those things out, now we can start kind of working. Next thing, IPSs. A lot of what's really common with intrusion prevention systems is you'll run into an intrusion prevention system only to find that if you encrypt your data to the web server, it's not protected by the IPS. I would go so far as to say that less than 10% of my clients have an IPS in intrusion prevention mode. If they have it, they usually have it in monitor mode because, you know, we don't want to block anything. That might be bad. What if we block something important? So then they buy this thing, they stick it in monitor mode. Now, if you get somebody who's brave enough, I hope I don't blue screen my machine by yanking this card out. Let's see. No blue screen. Pretty good. All right. If you have something and you have it in monitor mode, obviously you can't detect anything because nobody reads logs. Don't even lie to me. It's kind of like a woman saying, I don't usually do this. Don't lie to me. I know you don't read logs, right? So if you have an IDS, I know you're not reading logs. If you have an IPS, what? Why does everybody give me that look when I say that? Okay. So the next thing that we're trying to deal with is, let's say you're trying to figure out if the IPS actually blocks traffic when you're using HTTPS. So I use XINETD, I create a service called SSL test. I open up port quadruple 8, and I only allow access from 127.0.0.1. Any traffic that comes into port quadruple 8, I push into this shell script. So if you look at this shell script, you're gonna see Joe's command line ninja skills. One line, baby. So it says bin bash, open SSL quiet, and it goes straight to the targetcompany.com on port 443. Now any traffic that I send to that local host port quadruple 8 gets encapsulated in HTTPS. You're gonna find that the overwhelming majority of times when they have an IPS, they're not decrypting HTTPS. So they don't have an SSL accelerator or a reverse proxy or something that terminates the HTTPS traffic prior to it passing the IDS or IPS. So that's what we're testing for here. And we send that traffic against localhost directly at the target. And you'll find that if I run into that, real good way to get around it. Okay, next thing is Tor. Any guys familiar with Tor? Okay, great. Tor is awesome. One of the things I'm really struggling to get companies to do is block Tor exit nodes. If you know that you probably don't want people anonymously browsing your website, you don't think that's conducive to you getting their money, you might not want to allow Tor. So we run Tor, you see that I run Privoxy, and then I pipe all of my traffic through Tor when I scan. Problem with that is ungodly slow. So it's just one of those things that even though I use Tor, you're gonna find that I like to use proxies. too many people have proxy avoidance and proxy detection. So you're going to find that one of the things that I really like now is VPNs. So VPNs are great. Globally distributed VPNs like Viper VPN, CryptoTel, Ace VPN, they'll give you, 30, 40 IPs, globally. So you can start to do stuff, make your traffic look like it's coming from Germany, you get blocked, disconnect from the VPN, reconnect through Amsterdam, whatever. And now you can start testing to see what's the company's response time to malicious traffic and what types of things do they block? Because you're going to find that unless there's a compromise, generally no one investigates. They just block your IP address. So you can keep trying this stuff and keep getting your IP blocked and just keep moving to different IPs and keep testing until you can start to figure out what they're actually blocking and how to get around it. All right, last question. Are we forgetting something? And yes, we are. It is the buzzword of the web app security industry, web application firewalls. Let me throw this out there. Web application firewalls suck. Let's do this one more time. When I say it, web application firewalls suck. They're a horrible product. I hope there's no vendor in the room. Sorry. Web application firewalls suck. They absolutely, absolutely suck. They suck, people. They suck. They're freaking horrible. Oh my God, it's so bad. It was worse than my marriage. It was just bad, 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 bad. You're looking at that, you're like, who thought of this? But the PCI Council, in their infinite wisdom, decided that if you have cross-site scripting, SQL injection, or any web vulnerability, you don't need to fix it. You can deploy a web application firewall. So rather than fix the problem, you are allowed to suck. All right, so one of the things that you're going to find is the same way that you test for load balancing, you can use Firefox Live HTTP headers, make requests to the host, and send a valid request, and then immediately after that, send a cross-site scripting or SQL injection. And what you'll notice is the differences in the response. So let's say I request a file that's not valid, and I get a 404, but then I immediately request a cross-site scripting, and the 404 page looks different. You now know, okay, it's a layer 7 response. I'm up against a web application firewall. You'll start to get things like response code 999, response code 501, method not implemented. You start to get non-standard response codes or custom 404 pages. Those are those hints that let you know you're up against a web application firewall. Almost any packet that you send, any HTTP request that includes one of these things will generally make a web application firewall cough up one of those nasty error messages. Danger, Will Robinson, danger. You have attacked a web application firewall. And they throw up some big old thing on the screen, and it's like, your IP's being logged. Don't do that again. So the thing that really blows me away is this one, when it gives you the error code 999, and it's like, no hacking. I think that's just hilarious. Just freaking trips me out when I see that, man. Okay, so one of the things that I'm finding really, really works for these is, let's say you try to do something like Unicode. So you see I've got the percent sign 3C, all this kind of stuff, and you see that I got a 200 error code, but it's not a 200 response code, but it's not a standard response code. See how it actually tells me condition intercepted. If you actually look at the HTTP response, this messes up scanners. So people run Web Inspect and all these different scanners, App Scan or whatever, against the product, and every time it does something, lets a cross-site script an SQL injection to get an automatic 200, the scanner moves on. So this is great. The vendor will look at you and be like, look, our WAF is awesome. Your scanner says we have no security problems, right? But if you start using any other encoding methods, you'll start to see things that doesn't detect. So you're going to find that generally when you run up against the web application firewall, use different encoding methods. Use UTF-7, UTF-16, Unicode, or mix them. Make part of it in hex, part of it in Base64, part of it in Unicode. Break the whole thing up, and you'll find that most web application firewalls can't handle that. So if you can do that, you'll find that it's very, very easy to bypass most web application firewalls because it's too processor intensive to do all of the decoding back to ASCII prior to running the packet through the rule set. So this is a tool that myself and a couple of friends have been working on. It's called WAFWOOF. We use it to identify web application firewalls. So what we've been doing is we've been progressively fingerprinting all of these different WAF vendors out there, because one of the things that we actually noticed was most WAFs generally do not block your IP address. So if you send a bad packet, the WAF just like, psst, don't do that. And then if you do it again, it's kind of like, psst, don't do that. But it doesn't actually stop you. So if that's the case, you can brute force it. So now what we've been trying to do is compile a list of default rule sets of most of the WAF vendors, so that when we fingerprint the WAF against the website, we go, oh, I'm up against an Imperva or a Citrix NetScaler like Microsoft is running, hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You can start to go, okay, this is the default rule set that it's going to be running, and now let's try to see if it's got the default rule set or a non-standard rule set, because it's not going to block our IP. Make sense? Everybody, nod your head. Good. Okay, so back to the encoding trick. So this is an example of the Unicode encoding. You see it's a generic cross-site scripting, but we're gonna pass it through Unicode, now it turns into gibberish. And that same guy who gave us 200 condition intercepted now says, don't know what that is. So now we can see that we can now use any Unicode encoded payload to walk right by this web application firewall. So all that money you spent is now a waste. All right, remember I said web application firewalls suck? Everybody, do you remember or you forgot already? Okay, the web application firewalls suck? Does anybody here work for .NET Defender before I really start talking about how horrible their product is? Okay, no one works for them. Great. All right, so I was up against a pen test against a very large bank with this one, and you see up here I did a cross-site scripting attempt, and it tells me .NET Defender has blocked your request. It tells me my IP is going to be logged, gives me a trouble ticket number, I guess in case I want to call and be like, hey guys, I was trying to own your web server, and can you reference this trouble ticket number? You know, so it didn't like the cross-site scripting attack, so I tried an SQL injection, and he was cool with that. With absolutely no encoding, with nothing to that effect. So as long as I was just asking, hey, can you give me the database username? The WAF was like, sure, no problem. Pulled the little Toro Olay thing. It was like, yeah, go ahead and go. So when I tried to ask for other things, like I tried to say, okay, can I have the database version? He was like, ooh, bad. You can't ask for database information. So then I asked for it in Unicode, and it was like, oh, sure. You can have all the database information you want. So then after that, I was like, hey man, you mind giving me the admin password for the website? And the WAF was like, sure. But this time I didn't have to use any encoding. I didn't have to use any trick. That bad boy just says, select master DBO varbenda hex string password file. With no encoding at all. No tricks, nothing. You Google SQL injection, you'll probably get that syntax, and it worked completely against the WAF on the homepage of an $11 billion bank. Gotta love that. So I did this at a couple of conferences, and the people at .NET Defender got very pissed at me, and they hate me now. So they can kiss my, you know how it goes. I was told you guys are politically correct, so I shouldn't curse so much. I meant ass. Okay? All right, getting into the LAN. How do we get into the LAN from the web? We just showed you how to own stuff from the outside. Now, how do we get into the LAN? Getting into the LAN is great if we can use SQL injection against a lot of websites. You can use things like SQL Ninja. You can use things like SQL Map to do your SQL injection and upload Metasploit. Makes life awesome, as my buddy Rodrigo always says. It's awesome. So we own them with SQL injection. And then what's cool is with SQL map, you can just say, hey man, can you give me an operating system shell, just OS shell, and you can just drive the box. It's really, really cool. All right, so let's focus on the important stuff, not getting caught. Why does everybody laugh when I show this? All right, so the important thing is not getting caught. So the key word here is don't be a tiger. Okay, do not be a tiger. Okay, incidentally, is it just me? Or if you were a billionaire and your wife caught you, wouldn't you be like, so? Is it? Okay, that probably wasn't a politically correct thing to say. Sorry about that. Let's move on. Okay, filter evasion. One of the things that people tend to do is they tend to do filtering with client-side technologies, and that's wrong. It's wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong. You know, I have not seen client-side filtering work against SQL injection, cross-site scripting, those types of things. Generally too trivial to bypass. I know the guy who just spoke in front of me was talking about all this cool stuff, and I was eating brownies and drinking orange soda, so I really wasn't listening. Maybe he said something cool that proves me wrong. My experience is, doesn't work. So generally, if you use JavaScript or cross-site script, VB script, or any client-side technology to try to stop cross-site scripting and SQL injection, the person can just go up into the options and turn JavaScript off. So a lot of help that did. Or you can use a proxy to intercept the communication and change the request. So it's kind of a waste of time. A lot of people who write with frameworks like J2EE and things like that don't realize that their framework is writing all this JavaScript for them. So you'll be talking to a developer and he'll be like, but I didn't write that. And it's kind of like one of those things when you get the paternity test, right? It's not your fault, but it's still your problem. Anybody ever? You know what I'm saying? It's not your fault, but, you know, it's still your problem. You still got to deal with this. All right, next thing that we run into is restrictive blacklist. So one of the things that you'll see is developers who say, okay, well, I'm not going to allow special characters. No less than signs, greater than signs, exclamation points, single ticks, double ticks. Can't do anything, so you're not going to hit me with a 1 = 1. But, you know, last time I checked, 1's kind of like 1, right? 2's kind of like 2. It's still syntactically correct with SQL. So a lot of people, even though they try to do a lot of these things, don't realize that you can still concat true and false statements without using special characters. Next thing is signature-based IDS. Now, how many of you have this as your mouse pad? Come on, nerds in the room. Where's my people? That's what I'm talking about. You've got a mouse pad like this because everybody needs to be able to convert decimal to hex to ASCII, you know, at a moment's notice, right? On the fly, just bam, look, right? Okay, so you keep this handy so we can start looking at some IDS signatures. So let's say we see alert, TCP, any IP coming from any port going to our web servers. And if you look where it says content, he's looking for tick or 1 = 1. So we've got this IDS signature, we're looking for tick or 1 = 1. So now if you look at the bypass techniques, how can we bypass that? Can we say 2 = 2? Just a thought. Can we say 1 < 2? Yeah, I'm thinking we can. So is this signature worth anything? And I'm thinking the answer is no. No, really, no. But what you're gonna find is that it's great for detecting automated tools. It's great for detecting newbies. But once you start getting into this and really messing with these things, you're gonna find that this is about my opinion of intrusion detection systems. Generally, you catch something and everything else is just flying right by and flying right by. But people are so excited, they're like, I got one. I got it. Did you see? Here's the attacker, look. And all this stuff is just flying by and everyone's so excited about it. So I don't really get that with the whole intrusion detection thing. All right, let's say we want to get hardcore and we want to break out something like PCRE, Perl compatible regular expressions. So now you see that we're looking for the word and or the word or and the 1 = 1, and we're looking for the dash dash, the pound sign, and we've got the slash I to make sure it's case insensitive. Now bypassing this one is going to be really hard, right? I mean, what are we gonna do? 2 = 2, %sign 2D, %sign 2D. Now, if we go back and we check our mouse pad, %sign 2D is that dash dash. So are you seeing how here we just put it in hex? And now, excuse me, we've bypassed the signature. So that signature, again, people aren't realizing that these things are actually fairly trivial to bypass. Now, one of the things that I run into with some people is they'll say, yeah, but Joe, you're using Snort or you're using Mod Security. I mean, that's not a commercial product. And to which I responded, you know, now that I actually work for a vendor and I don't work for a vendor anymore, I'm going to wave the bullshit flag. Anybody put bullshit? Yeah, but bullshit. Yeah, I'm thinking bullshit. Because you go to a security company and you go to the dev team and it's like two guys. You know, the fate of the IT security world is defined by two dudes. You know, two dudes are like, yeah, man, well, I was reading Security Focus today and they got this new vulnerability. You think you ought to write a signature for it? The other guy's like, Well, I mean, I'm still playing Xbox right now, but what do you think? Okay, after this game. And then they write a signature. So now, how many of you thought it was like some big board, you know, some big grandiose thing? If you go to most security companies that actually have a security product, most of those companies are less than 30 people. I mean, anybody? Is it just me? Okay, it's getting real quiet out there. You guys did not know this. Okay, lesson number one. Security companies are small. The world thinks they are big. Okay, everybody getting that? The world thinks these people know everything, and they don't. Cool? All right, lesson learned. Okay, so we're seeing here, we've got a more complex IDS signature that's actually looking for select statements, looking for union statements, and you'll see in blue the bypass technique. We just put the entire attack string in hex. So now we walk right by the IDS signature again. Now let's say you're really hardcore, and you wanna write IDS signatures that include the percent sign 73 for the S, percent sign 65 for the E, and you're gonna spell out every single letter in the select, union, order by, group by, and all of the different possible iterations of SQL injection and cross-site scripting. You're gonna write each of them all out in hex. Anybody feeling that one? All right, and then the attacker will use UTF-7, or the attacker will use Unicode, or a mix of the two, right? This is one of the things that people fundamentally don't understand, right? It's just one of those things that you have to start looking at it and saying, if you're gonna have a web application firewall, it's probably better to do it as an ISOPI extension so that you don't have to deal with all these different encoding things. So you're gonna find that some of these web application firewalls that actually integrate with IIS as an ISOPI extension generally are more effective. I don't want to say always, but generally are more effective because you won't have to deal with so much of this encoding stuff. The web application firewall receives it in essentially ASCII, and it can run right against its default rule set. Okay, next thing, PHP IDS. Absolutely love PHP IDS. PHP IDS has what's called a smoke test. So you can get out there and you can try all your SQL injection, cross-site scripting payloads, and then they score you for what signatures that they flag. I absolutely love this. I try to practice every weekend while I'm drinking. So that's how I know kind of how I'm doing. And you can see on the left side that my score is a 26. On the right side, my score is a 22 just by changing the syntax, right? So then you keep modifying the syntax that you use until it finally says, hey man, it's good. Right, so then that's the syntax that I go use when I'm on pen test. So those websites like what the guy was talking about in front of me, where he's like, hey, go try all these payloads and try to break our filter. Those are the types of websites that I use before I go on a pen test so I can make sure I'm using the right kinds of payloads that bypass most security solutions. Mod Security now has a demo for this as well, and it integrates with PHP IDS. Very, very cool. All right, so I absolutely think signature-based IDS is a waste of time. If you are gonna use a signature-based IDS solution, you really wanna look for a product that does what's called normalization, where it takes all traffic and tries to decode it back to ASCII before passing it by the rule set. You wanna look into things like that. You wanna make sure that HTTPS isn't messing up things, encoding isn't messing up things. You know, that's really what's kinda tearing people up. All right, so getting into the LAN via client side, anybody use Metasploit, you're gonna find that this is just too easy. So basically you just say use exploit, whatever the newest browser, PDF, ActiveX, or file format exploit is, make it reverse shell back out to you. So as soon as you send that bad boy in, it kicks out a shell and you're driving on the internal LAN because everyone will click. Everyone? Everyone. Everyone will click. Somebody is going to click that bad boy. My best one, my absolute best one, is to take a CD and write 2010 salary on it and put that bad boy in the bathroom. I guarantee you, somebody's going to be on that bad boy dropping a deuce, look over and be like, salary? I wonder if that bitch down the hall makes more money than me. You know what? Right? They got to, right? Now, what if you got one of those really aware users who's like, you know what? This is probably some really proprietary stuff. I better take this to my supervisor. So they take it to the supervisor. What does their supervisor do? He puts it in his machine. Insta-shell, baby, Insta-shell. Just add the toilet, that's all. Okay, so Social Engineering Toolkit actually automates a lot of this stuff for you. If you want to generate the Metasploit payloads that work on the USB sticks or work in DVD-ROMs, or you want to clone a website and all that stuff's built right in, man. Just makes it too easy. Open up the little menu, go through the menus, and then kick back, get yourself a sandwich, start owning boxes. It just makes life too easy. Okay, pivoting into the LAM, as soon as somebody actually clicks on it, you want to immediately add them as your new default gateway and route your traffic into the LAM through that. So it's just a couple of really easy commands. Next thing I run into is NAC solutions. So DHCP MAC reservations, port security, network access control solutions. I think these solutions suck as well. So you get into a lot of these networks, and you're gonna see that the way that you get by this stuff is generally pretty easy, right? If there's no DHCP, find somebody's IP address. If they've got DHCP MAC reservations, unplug somebody's machine, use their MAC address, pretty easy. Generally, you just grab the back of the machine, look, you see the MAC address right on it, too easy. If they have port security, same thing, it's all MAC based. If they're using things like 802.1x, what I do in those cases, because it's usually 802.1x with backend radius authentication, so I look for exceptions. So I find a printer, I find a voice over IP phone, walk over, hit the buttons on the printer till you get the IP and MAC, unplug that bad boy, plug in your laptop, because now you found something that's not 802.1x compliant, so it needs to be an exception. So people spend all this money on these NAC solutions only to find out that they have to exclude whole VLANs of stuff. Hey, I have to exclude the entire voice VLAN. Hey, I have to exclude the entire printer VLAN, because all these things don't support 802.1x. So you just hang over, oh, well, let me just unplug the printer. And now, boom, I'm on the LAN, right? So you spend all that money on that cool solution, but the sales guys really don't explain to you how the exclusions work and how people attempt to bypass that stuff. All right, so another thing that's really cool is a lot of VLAN solutions will implement CDP. So they're using CDP and it automatically moves your phone into the voice VLAN. Any of you guys see that where it comes out of the wall, plugs into your phone, comes out of your phone, plugs into your PC, and your phone's automatically on the voice VLAN just based on its MAC address. You can do the same thing. You can implement VLAN tagging on your laptop and then make it look like a voice over IP phone. So as soon as you plug into the network, you know, the network says, oh, it's a new voice over IP phone, moves you into the voice VLAN. Now you need to be able to communicate with the call manager. The call manager is usually a server in the server VLAN. So now they've not only excluded you from the network access control solution, but they've also routed you directly into the DMZ with all of the servers and the domain controllers and all that, you know, important stuff that they spend all that money to try and keep you away from. Gotta love that. All right, so next thing is, as soon as we're on the box, one of the things that I like to do, I really don't port scan very much. I use a lot of net commands because, well, what are they going to do? Stop you from using network neighborhood? Really? So using net commands are a great way to enumerate the network, find out what users are in what domains. You know, as long as you have one regular user set of credentials, you can use net commands across the entire network. And then if you just get to a command prompt and run system info, generally you're gonna get a list of all the patches, hot fixes, and all that stuff and configuration for that machine. And since most people use imaging, it's a pretty good idea that the entire network looks like that. So as soon as you pop one box, you run system info, figure out what stuff is on it. So now there's no need to port scan. You just use net commands to figure out what's where, and you can generally assume that most machines are going to be configured fairly similar to yours. So you don't have to port scan, you don't have to use tactics that people are generally looking for. Okay, now, as soon as we know that, and we start figuring out with the net commands which user is in the admin groups, now we got to look for that user. So we can look through the network using the ps logged in command, ps exec, wmic, and we can find that user and try to see, you know, what machine he's actually logged into, because if we can get on his box, now we're domain admin, okay? All right, so let's move in around the network. You can use the pass the hash technique where you actually take the username password hash from one machine and use that over SMB to move laterally through the network. And then you can do privilege escalation. Privilege escalation is one of those things that I have to do a lot. If you're up against networks where they have host intrusion prevention, generally, or they have antivirus that you can't turn off, anybody ever do that? You turn off your antivirus, a couple minutes later, it comes right back on. So this is a good example. I ran into this at that same bank where I found the SQL injection. So they had the McAfee framework service, you see it? And here I just do, I escalate to system with the at command on a Windows XP machine. I run netstop on the McAfee service, netstop the hips, netstop intercept agent, netstop fire PM. And then down here, this last one, unload the EPO hips DLL. So that regserve32-u fire epo.dll, that's the DLL that I got to yank out of memory so that it doesn't keep restarting. So as soon as you can do that, that's usually how I get around that stuff. If you can escalate to system, it really doesn't matter what they have on the box. Because once you escalate to system, you can just turn it off. You know, and that's generally what I do. So I've run into other systems. So let's say I find a vulnerability. If I can get physical access to it, I'll unplug it, plug a crossover cable between it and my laptop, and then pop that box. So even if it has host intrusion prevention system on it, it can't call home to mommy. You know, because I ran a crossover cable to it. So I pop it, turn everything off, plug it back into the network. Now, when a box goes off the network, generally, and it's a user workstation, most of those things don't really make a big stink because a box went offline. They generally think, oh, person turned off his PC or whatever. So it's generally not a big deal. Now, if they're using group policy refresh rate is like, what, 90 minutes or something like that? So with those types of things, you might have to worry about, you know, group policy hitting and then turning it back on. But again, if you've got system, you can just turn it right back off again, that kind of thing. All right, I already talked about killing the hips, right? All right, owning the domain, cool little thing called incognito, it's token stealing. So one of the things that you guys implemented was to allow for faster logon. So once a higher level privileged account touches a Windows box, that account's token stays in memory. So if we can occupy the same area of memory, we can steal that person's token and we can impersonate them. So let's say I get local admin on a box, but I'm not domain admin. If a domain admin or help desk user or somebody with higher privileges logs into the box and the box doesn't reboot, their token stays in memory. If I can get local admin access, I can steal that token and I can now impersonate that account. So that's the way that I get domain admin. I just move around the network until I find a box that the domain admin is logged into or that a service account is logged into, and I'll steal that token and I'll impersonate that user, add myself to the domain as a domain admin level user if necessary. Okay, that's about it. So here's my contact info. I'll take some questions. If anybody wants to holler at me, ask me anything, buy me a drink, I'll answer more questions. But you know, we'll take some simple ones right now. Anything? Everybody bored to tears? You guys ready to go, huh? Everybody, let's go. Okay, I'll wrap it up. Oh, we do have questions. My bad, I was ready to go. I was trying to drink, man. You're really messing with my chi right now, man.
I just wanted to make a quick comment. It's .defender, not to be mistaken with anything .net.
I was just talking to some guys earlier. I don't remember their names. They were on the engineering team, and I had a .net bug that I showed them. So I got a trick for your .net stuff, too, if that makes you feel any better. He told me I should like submit a bug report. He's like, hey, you should like submit that. What's up, man?
Hi, great talk, thank you very much.
Hey, you're welcome very much.
The last vulnerability you mentioned, the higher privileged account logging on to your machine, and if you have admin, you can actually use his token to authenticate somewhere else. It sounds like a big vulnerability to me because, for instance, at Microsoft, pretty much everyone is admin of their machines. And if you ever convince a higher privileged account, like a domain administrator or someone, log on to your computer, that's it. You are now domain admin.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's a bad one, man. I'm not the one who designed Active Directory. Maybe you guys know somebody.
So there's no catch, no like exception. That. It's like, that simple?
No. SMB signing, encryption, all that stuff isn't going to work because it's actually the way that it's implemented. There is, however, one of the settings that you can use for other accounts. When you create accounts in Active Directory, you can say this account is not allowed for delegation. And that's one of the ways you can turn that off. But what ends up happening is people use service accounts for patch management and system configuration and things like that. So those accounts are rolling, touching all the boxes, applying patches or whatever it is that they're doing to all the machines. And unless the machine reboots, that token is still in memory. So it's one of those things that, what's his name, Frank Jennings? Was it Frank Jennings who came up with that? His last name is Jennings, and he came up with the whole token stealing thing. And he's got a list of mitigations, and they're all configuration options.
Server Cejudo always gives talks about that.
Yeah. So there really is mitigations for how you configure Active Directory, but at the end of the day, it really comes down to privilege and credential management. You know, it's a lot more work than people think. People, for some reason, don't really look at the way hackers utilize these vulnerabilities. Like what I tried to do was just kind of show you how to put them all together. I mean, none of these are new. What do you think? All this stuff is at least 5-6 years old. I haven't showed anything new here today.
Thank you.
No problem, bud. Somebody on the back.
Thank you. Good talk, by the way.
Thanks, man.
I have a quick question. So you mentioned in the beginning that your customers weren't really interested in hearing about social engineering or stuff like that.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you had noticed a change now with some of the stuff that Verizon published and some of the stuff that Adam was talking about today, or if you see that changing going forward.
The only thing that I could sell you in that regard is you're only dealing with the customers knowing that if you have an educated CIO. If you have a CIO who's really up on it, listening to podcasts and reading these threat reports, those are the only times. And even in those situations, when that CIO has to go with all his other three-letter buddies, the CFO and CEO and all that, this is going to sound real bad by analogy, but CIOs are kind of like the little brother in the executive group. Anybody ever pick on your little brother? It's kind of like that, right? So, you know, basically, think of the dynamics, right? Okay, you're the dude who controls all the technology, right? The CFO, he's got the checkbook. So anything he says, hey, we got the money. I'm going to tell you what we can and can't afford, right? And then the COO, the ops guys, is like, yo, I make the money up in here. So the CIO is kind of like, well, I manage the servers. You know, so he kind of gets pushed around by everybody. What the CIO needs to do is be like, how about I just turn all these servers off? Let me see how much money you got. Let me see how many ops you run. You kind of see what I mean? You need an educated, aggressive CIO to really get that kind of stuff going on. Every time I run into CIOs, you know, I'm finding that they're always asking for help because they're always like, well, I need to take that to my board. I need to, you know. But what you got to do, man, if you're the CIO, you got to, you know, buck up. Like, I'm going to turn all this stuff off. Let me see how many operations you run, right? Show what security does from a productivity standpoint. And that's how we justify the impact of return on security investment. So if you can say, listen, as we apply security controls, we start keeping metrics of things like hours without incident. So hours without incident translates to productivity. That translates to money. So now we can start saying, listen, when we apply security controls, the network functions better, the applications have less defects, we get more uptime, we get more time that we're making money. And CIOs need to speak that way. Same thing about social engineering. They have to say that that is a vector that attackers can use against us. So simple answer, no. I'm not seeing a whole lot with social engineering as the clients knowing more about it. Unless it's those few really educated clients, you know. And then just for you guys, dealing with customers and dealing with different business units, try to get those guys to understand that, you know, people think security does not make money. But if security is implemented correctly, it does enhance your ability to make money. Okay? We running out of time? Oh, we got time? Okay, any more questions?
Hey, Joe. Over here on the other side. Yep.
Oh, what's up, man?
A few questions.
Sure.
You mentioned token stealing, and I was thinking past the hash as well, and you also mentioned that. How much would pass the hash and token stealing, if those disappeared, how much would that really slow you down? Would it be significant?
A lot. If you could stop token stealing and you could stop pass the hash, you would do a lot to me as an attacker. I have one customer who implemented IPsec internally.
The domain isolation type of, like using IPsec for domain isolation?
Yes, okay. And I thought that was very good. So essentially what they did is they had server network, admin network, and workstation network. Inter-workstation communication was not allowed via IPsec rules.
That was my follow-up.
Okay, and I have found that to be unbelievably tough to work through, because I can phish somebody, and then I'm not allowed to communicate with another workstation. Mm-hmm. So generally what I did in that environment was I attacked their SAN. So they had an EMC SAN. I hope I'm not like bashing EMC, but yeah. So I owned their EMC SAN because I couldn't go laterally, you know, to the other workstation. So it forced me to have to go somewhere else. If you could do domain isolation, not allow workstation communication, and you force people to use a SAN for file sharing, I think you are going to cut down on malware like there is no tomorrow, because it will have a difficult time moving laterally. The other thing that I would really look to do is try to do DNS logging of at least 12 months. So if you're recording all DNS queries, try to keep them for at least 12 months. So what will happen is you'll see malware beacon to a specific domain or its fallback domains. Now you can look through your DNS records for the last 12 months, and you can be like, okay, these six other machines beacon to those domains as well. It helps us find boxes that have been compromised.
Okay, follow up. Another measure, application whitelisting. Have you come across many places that use something like AppLocker or other commercial available?
Yes,
and
I have.
Is it significant roadblock?
Yes, it's tough. Essentially, what you keep doing is, I'm going to try to not make an offensive analogy. I'm going to try so hard. Okay, what you keep running into is every time they hit you with something, you got to try and find something else. So if I can't move laterally in the network, then you're going to stop a lot of automated malware. If you start doing the application whitelisting, BitLocker or AppLocker and all that kind of stuff, then he's going to have to find something that he can exploit and stay inside an authorized process. So just because you say these processes or these applications are trusted, that does not mean I won't own that app. Mm-hmm. Right, so if you could say, hey, he can only run Excel, but if I send you an Excel exploit,
game over.
You know, what good is that? Because now you're in the same process space. That's the same way that we bypass SRP. So we have an Excel spreadsheet that has macros built into it, and the macros actually do DLL injection. So you have software restriction policy that says I can only run SRP. I load a macro, I load my DLL into memory, and now if you've got DLL injection, you can now bypass GPOs. You can do all of that stuff.
And one last thing.
Sure.
It seems like a lot of the issues, which I've sort of seen as well, and it seems like mainly you're trying to make it hard enough to make someone give up, because someone's eventually going to find a way in. Would that be your experience?
No, that wouldn't be. That wouldn't be. Now, you can take it other ways. I've had 11 years of pen testing, and I've had two networks we haven't been able to get into. So, yeah, the odds aren't good, but you know, if people do the right things, you know, we can't make it impossible, you know, but we want to make it as hard as possible. Exactly what you guys are doing with all these exploit mitigations, you know, DEP, ASLR, you know, /GS and all these different things that you're in, you know, safe unlinking, heap cookies. You know, you guys got 50 million things that's, you know, making it hard for me to try to write exploits. It's forcing people to go somewhere else so that, hey, well, having a tough time owning Microsoft, let's own Adobe. Kind of see it? Mm-hmm. You know, that's what you're trying to do, right? In the network, you're trying to do the same thing. Try to make it so that if you have a tough time getting this, they got to go to something else, right? And it's if you keep doing that, eventually they got to go somewhere else. Cool?
Yep, thanks a lot.
No problem, man. Anybody else? All right. Oh, question.
Hey, Quest. Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Have you? What do you think about SIMs? Are they a very good?
Oh, God, why'd you have to? Damn. Oh man.
Security information managers, SIMSEMSIEMEIEIO.
They suck.
You're a
sinner, Jeff. They suck. They're horrible. Okay, issue with SIMS. Oh, God, I really don't want to disclose that I worked for a SIM provider. Okay, so issues with SIMS, they're so bad for one very specific reason. It's a garbage in, garbage out product. For those of us who had the horrible misfortune of being an IDS analyst, we had to tune our IDS, right? Constantly tuning the signatures to make sure we weed out the false positives, constantly tuning the signatures that forced us to drop packets, all that kind of stuff. As soon as you move to a SIM environment, what happens is people stop tuning their IDS. They go, well, I got a SIM that does correlation for me. So now we're taking logs from the servers, the routers, the switches, the firewalls, and the IDS, and we're not tuning any of those logs. So if we get a false positive, so for example, a really good one, MS-0867, right, the NetAPI version 3 exploit that exploits the NetAPI DLL, generally against most IDSs gets classified as MS-0640. So your SIM will generally run its vulnerability scan and say, you know what, that box is Windows XP. It's not vulnerable to a Windows 2000 exploit. So because of the correlation and because the IDS misclassified it, it doesn't escalate to a trouble ticket. So this box is now owned, right? Because no one wanted to take the time to really tune the IDS and get some real eyes to look at what's going on under the hood. So my issue with SIMs is that you really need pro services to get in there and help you tune these things and write custom rules for your environment. It's not the type of thing that you can grab, spend a couple hundred grand on, slide it into the rack. Because remember, RSA deploys a SIM. I don't know if anybody knew that. Like, RSA has a product called Envision that they ran across their whole freaking network. Maybe it worked because they found out that they were owned. I mean, you can look at it that way. You know, but yeah, I'm not a big fan of SIMs without a whole lot of tuning, a whole lot of work. And I think that's the reason that people buy SIMs, because they don't want to do the work, not realizing that it's actually more work to implement a SIM, in my opinion. Okay? Any other questions? Everybody's like straight walking out. I must be offending so many people. Andrew, I don't think it was a good idea to bring me here. I've been offending people. All right, we good? Citrix NetScaler, if I reveal anything else, did the FBI guy leave?
Oh, yeah, he's been gone for a long time.
Do you have a sales perspective for us?
Sales of what products?
No. Normally that's how you do your sales leads, I
love Andrew. Absolutely love Andrew.
Okay, yes. Andrew, if you have any other questions, you can ask them maybe a little bit later. We are going to go ahead and wrap up this block. Joe, thank you so much. Let's give him a big hand for waking us all up. Absolutely.